Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody! Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. This week, we are looking at Ford of Doomsday. Wait, don't change the channel. This is a good episode, I promise. This is the second of 10 straight Peter Davison novelizations, starting with Castro Valva, which we covered last week on episode 76. That means that more than half of Peter's era all came out in book form in about a year. Even though this novelization may be an adaptation of not one of Peter's most popular stories according to the usual online surveys and DWM polls, we have a full-sized episode for you with two terrific, terrific guests coming up this week. First, we'll talk a little bit about some other news. I recently guested on Trap One to discuss the Season 9 Blu-ray collection. That episode was released a few days ago, and I will put a link to that in the show notes. Always a blast talking with the Trap One crew. We have some news that a new novelization of Evil of the Daleks is coming out later this year. Now, wait a minute, you say, Jason. John Peel wrote a novelization of Evil of the Daleks about 30 years ago. Yes, and that'll be coming up on this show towards the very end of its run. It was one of the last of the original Target novelizations. But what's coming up is a novelization of the Evil of the Daleks rerun, which was aired on the BBC in between The Wheel in Space and The Dominators to bridge the gap between TV Season 5 and TV Season 6. Fraser Hines is evidently writing a first-person novelization, or at least a novelization told from Jamie's point of view, covering the Doctor's rerunning of that story for Zoe through mental projection. And there are going to be some interesting subplots added to the text. This is Fraser Hines' first novel. This should be really, really interesting. We will definitely be covering that on Trap One. And perhaps when it comes up again in publication order on this podcast, towards the very end of my run. We also learned that Indira Varma is coming back to the Doctor Who universe after featuring on Season 1 of Torchwood, and then more recently having a pretty prominent role on the Star Wars Kenobi series. She is coming back to the Russell T. Davies 2.0 series to play a character called the Duchess. No, she's not going to be playing the Ronnie. That theory comes about every time a prominent female role has been cast on Doctor Who from 2005 to the present. Indira Varma is the Duchess, not the Ronnie. Well, probably not the Ronnie. This week, I have two guests recorded in three different time zones, 4 months apart. First, I'll be playing with you the rest of my interview with Jason Davis, which we recorded back at Galley in the middle of a crowded hallway. You can hear the background noise. I played the first half of this conversation back in my bonus episode in between the 1981 books and the 1982 books. We talked a bit about Jason's working relationship with Harlan Ellison and how Harlan Ellison came to write the preface, or the introduction, to the 10 pinnacle Doctor Who novelizations that were released from the late 1970s through the late 1980s. I was planning on running that whole interview again this week, but as it turns out, the episode is going much longer than expected, so I will just refer you back. That was the bonus episode in between episodes 65 and 66 of this podcast. You can find it by going back to my Spotify website and scrolling down. I will also put a link to that in the show notes, of course. Earlier this week on Twitter, I posted a photo of my copy of Ford of Doomsday with the B. Dalton Booksellers $3.25 price tag still on the cover from when I bought this book in the mid-1980s. And I got a tremendous amount of feedback, probably one of the most popular single things I've ever posted on Twitter. Matt West from Milk Publishing and the Cue the Wing podcast with Andrew Cartmell joined in. And he made a really, really neat comment about Ford of Doomsday that I had never thought about before. So I reached out to Matt, and he appeared on the show. We recorded an interview this morning. I'm recording this late on Saturday night, and he joined me on Saturday morning. Well, Saturday afternoon from the UK, from his perspective. And we have a really excellent conversation about Ford of Doomsday and many other fandom interests. Jason Davis was in on that conversation on Twitter, and this evening I recorded a supplemental interview with Jason, and we talk a little bit more about some Ford of Doomsday topics we did not get to cover in the LAX Marriott back at Gallifrey One in Los Angeles in February. And of course, he and I having very similar TV and sci-fi interests, we will talk a lot about Twilight Zone and more about Harlan Ellison. And we're even going to talk about one of my favorite non-sci-fi shows, Better Call Saul. Or perhaps Better Call Saul is a sci-fi series. Jason and I will talk about that a little bit later on in the program. So, lots going on today. Three interviews with two guests. And then my breakdown of the text of the novelization. Let's get to it.
Hi, I'm Rupert Booth.
I am known as Paul Ferry.
My name is Barry Williams.
Together, we host Time Ram.
Time Ram's a cruel mistress.
It's a random number generator.
That also.
We roll a number from 1 to 30, and that's our doctor. Then 1 to 300 for the story, and then we ram them together.
Even if it doesn't make sense.
Cruel, I tell you.
Time Ram, putting the wrong doctors in the wrong stories, so you don't have to.
You're listening to Doctor Who Literature.
I wanted to talk to you about a Doctor Who novelization, because you and I have both been reading them now since the 1980s. We've all read Harlan's Introduction to the Pinnacle. We've read the Pinnacles, we've read the Targets. Introduce us to the Target book that I imposed upon you to talk about for this conversation.
You gave me a choice, actually. And I probably chose a different one than what you would have imagined between the two that you gave me. You gave me the option of four weddings and a funeral. I have gone completely bonkers.
Hugh Grant does have a Doctor Who connection.
He does have a Doctor Who connection, indeed, as does Richard Curtis. Ford of Doomsday and Earthshock were the two you offered me. And initially, my first thought was Earthshock, because A, I'd never read a novelization by Ian Martyr, and B, it's a good story. I don't particularly like Ford of Doomsday. But then I thought, no. On the Doctor Who Literature podcast, I must talk about the first book to describe Peter Davison's face as open. It's not a pleasant open face yet, but it is an open face, Terrence's stock phrase,
yes,
for Peter Davison's face. So that is why I chose Ford of Doomsday.
What was the very first Target book that you read? Was it the Seeds of Doom?
No, it was Ark of Infinity.
Ark of Infinity, wow.
Yes, with a lovely picture of Alfred and the Doctor on the cover.
Giving away the end of part three plot twist that Chancellor Heaton is the bad guy. Not the best editorial choice on the cover art. Nothing to do with Terrence.
Well, lucky for them, I didn't know who he was playing. So I just knew it was a bad Time Lord.
Huh.
So I was lucky in that regard. That was the first one, and I read The Five Doctors almost immediately thereafter, and beyond that, it became a steady stream because I had a class in school where they had us bring a book every day and do 30 minutes of reading, and I just went through a ton of Targets in that time.
Wow.
But I hadn't read Ford of Doomsday, and I'm glad that I read it after the Blu-ray release with the updated production subtitles, because I was able to immediately determine, based on having read the subtitles, that Terrence was working from the camera scripts and not the finished episode. The sodium chloride exchange is as scripted by Terrence Dudley and not as performed by the cast and crew.
That's an interesting... I had never put that connection together, but as I am doing my audio essays for the series, I have the book in one hand and I have the episode transcript on the website in the other. So every two scenes, I will tall back, put the book down,
read the episode transcript, and you notice some fascinating alterations. So, for example, in Keeper of Trakan, Terrence adds so many deleted scenes. There is so much material in his novelization of Trakan that wasn't on television, and it makes the book a very rich experience.
Mm-hmm.
As you and I are talking, I have recently done the audio essay for Unearthly Child, which is... the episode is out already by the time you're listening to this, but the episode has not been released as we're talking. It is fascinating to watch how Terrence takes the words on TV or the words on the camera script and tells a story. So I had not made that connection yet about Ford of Doomsday. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I was thinking about just the logic of it, and I don't know the process. I would love to have discussed more with, you know, I talked to him a few times when he was at Gallifrey. And I would love to know more about the process, whether or not tapes were made accessible to people, you know, or were they handed the scripts, and if so, where did the scripts come from? Because in talking, you know, on Twitter to Richard Molesworth, you know, he says that the scripts don't necessarily come from the BBC written archives at Caversham. Sometimes they're just lent to the production by fans who scan them and then they put them on there. So, you know, I don't know what sort of archive was available. Obviously, Terrence was writing this in, you know, it came out in, what, 83. He was probably writing it in, let's say, 82 if we give him a 6 months to a year lead time. The scripts were probably still sitting around the office at that point, I would assume. Wouldn't have been difficult to get them to him. Interestingly, Terrence Dudley novelized his own scripts for the next two stories he did.
Yes.
So I don't know what the, you know, I'd love to know the backstory on why Terrence got the first one and then the other Terrence, as it were, two Jasons talking about two Terrences, got the other one. You know, I have no idea what the politicking there was all about. But it's interesting, I noticed a couple of times early on, he actually put some psychological, you know, reasoning behind some of the lines. And it's almost, you know, I think you've mentioned it before, that Terrence sometimes editorializes on the original script. If there's something, you know, he'll say, somebody will give a line of dialogue and Terrence will say, the doctor thought that was a fatuous remark. You know, something like that, basically to criticize a line of dialogue that he had to include because it's a novelization of that dramatic event. But at the same time, he thought it was a bad line. So, you know, there's a little bit of that happening. There's a bit about the doctor finding it easy to manipulate Tegan by telling her to do one thing and knowing she'll do the opposite. Which I was like, well, you know, that's just early McCoy era Doctor Who manipulation creeping in, you know, a little bit in advance. But there's less of that than I would have thought based on the first couple of chapters. It gets very... a very straight adaptation after that, after a few of those little flourishes early on.
You can see the deadline rapidly approaching.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things where I think this was certainly not during his best era of novelization. You know, this is the... you were talking recently about the era where they started getting thinner and thinner and thinner, and he was doing 9 or 10 in a year.
Yes, this is after that era, but at the same time, Terrence is writing many other books for Target and many other series, so he probably didn't have a full leisurely year
exactly
to write this with a quill pen and a pot of ink. You talk a lot about the differences between the camera script and the finished production. Other Terrence books, you can see that he's novelizing the stage directions, which end up being heavily changed in the edit. So if you look at the opening pan of Space and Mysterious Planet, he's novelizing Robert Holmes' stage directions, which is not what ends up on screen.
Right.
And it's the same later on for Caves of Andrew. When I was talking with Paul Schoons, we learned one of the lines that Terrence uses to describe the sound of a mud burst in Caves of Andrew's line, it comes directly from a Robert Holmes stage direction.
Yeah. And that seems like the most logical way of doing it, because, I mean, you don't want to be starting and stopping a VHS tape.
Right.
You know, so I have to assume that 9 times out of 10, you know, he was working from the script, probably had it next to his typewriter or later his word processor, you know, I don't know when he adopted an electronic writing medium, but I'm sure, you know, probably by the late 80s, given somebody as prolific as he was, or maybe he was just a traditionalist like Harlan, you know, and was working on a typewriter to the end. But, maybe he watched the tape once, you know, at the office or something. I don't know. I would love to know what the process was on that.
It definitely gives his book a very rich visual feel. And as you say, when he editorializes as he goes, he's often accused of doing mere script-to-screen transfers, And I've been saying on this podcast for a year and a half now, that is not the case. Terrence is doing so much more subtle work than that.
He tidies up a lot. You know, I kind of wish there'd been a little bit more tidying of Monarch's plot, which I still don't quite understand in the grand scheme of things.
It would be hard to reconcile that without writing a 500-page book rather than 120 pages.
Yeah, certainly. You know, I think this might be one of those cases where he looked at it, you know, thought about the plot as, you know, Monarch's plot, not the plot of the story, and thought, you know, the frog who abducts people every several thousand years, turns them into androids, and then comes back to poison the planet on his fifth visit. You know, it makes the master seem, you know, the Ainley master, let's say, really goal-oriented by comparison.
Or the Sacha Devon master in Power of the Doctor, which is a bonkers plan if you think about it.
Yes, yes. there are a number of master plans, whether actually conceived by the Master or some other antagonist, that I call them TV plots. Mm. You know, they're plots that aren't, that they're meant to be seen once as a TV show goes out and never to be thought of again. And they do not anticipate novelizations, home video, repeats, streaming, or the future.
Or you and I standing among 3,000 fellow Doctor Who fans at a convention in Los Angeles 40 years after this got written for TV, released, and then turned into a book with yellowing pages.
Yes, yes, that is certainly the case, and I very much doubt we can hold Terence Dudley responsible for that.
If you look at Terence Dudley's first novelization, King's Demons, he changes the end of that TV story so much for the novelization.
Does he?
And we'll get to that in turn, but you can see him thinking, wait a minute, this doesn't work on TV. I've got extra space now, let me change the ending and make it more satisfactory, which he does. So perhaps if Terence Dudley had novelized this, maybe we would have had a rewritten ending that puts Monarch's plans in context, but that is beyond Terence's powers working from the camera script.
Yeah, certainly. Terence Dudley's an interesting guy, too. I don't know if you've seen Doomwatch or Survivors, both sort of sibling shows to Doctor Who, the first one created by Kit Pedler and Jerry Davis, the latter by Terry Nation. In both cases, those guys were the sort of prime movers on season one, and in both cases, Terence Dudley took over for seasons two and three. And, you know, for better or worse, change the concept of the show in such a way that in both cases the original creators were displeased with what resulted. But an interesting figure, and then he retired from producing and directing after doing Megalos and, you know, started writing. And he had been one of the people approached originally for Doctor Who by, I don't know if it was before David Whittaker or after Whittaker was in charge, but he was, you know, he was consulted early on, didn't do anything, but...
What's interesting is that Doctor Who in the 60s is basically a product of radical young peoples in their 20s. There was that one surviving photo of David Whittaker where he appears to be in his 50s. I always assumed David Whittaker was an old man working on Doctor Who. You and I have just come from Simon Gurrier's amazing panel on David Whittaker at Galley. David Whittaker is 30 or 31 when he's the script editor, and Verity Lambert's in her late 20s, Waris Hussein is in his mid-20s. These are young people doing incredibly transformative work. Terence Dudley, on the other hand, was probably the oldest person to write for classic Doctor Who because he was already in his 60s, twice the age of so many of the other writers.
Yeah, very much so. He was, you know, established guy. He was retired. I mean, he was effectively had retired from his staff job at the BBC. This was kind of his, you know, retirement gig, was writing these three Doctor Who serials.
And he ends up writing 15% of Peter Davison's era, 3 out of 20 stories.
Yeah. Two-parters, you know, so he's like the king of the two-parters, if that's a distinction. And apparently, I gather he wrote Black Orchid first and submitted it, and I guess they determined it needed more work, and he managed to turn around four to Doomsday in the interim, and of course then the first story, Project Zeta Sigma, fell out, and the new script editor, who was, you know, trying to do the job while John Nathan Turner was, I think, in America on a convention from what's said, went to Barry Letts and said, look, I don't think this is going to work.
Anthony Root on a 90-day contract. On the, you and I were talking earlier offline about the Blu-ray including the production files.
Right.
The production file for Ford and Doomsday may be the last time Barry Letts touches a classic Doctor Who script. And he says to Anthony Root, this isn't going to work. It needs a major rewrite. My contract is up. I can't do it. Imagine if Barry Letts had gotten extended and had to go at Ford and Doomsday. Again, maybe part four makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting period in time, because, I mean, the fact that we had Barry Letts as the sort of outgoing executive producer, a weird position, you know, a weird sort of oversight position over John Nathan Turner's first season. It's something that doesn't happen anywhere else in Doctor Who.
Before or since.
Yeah, I mean, the traditional explanation is that John Nathan Turner didn't have a script background. But, you know, I don't know if it was a departmental organizational thing that they were trying out, they decided not to continue. You know, did anybody else have this sort of supervisory capacity on any other contemporary shows? I don't know.
So I'll ask you two open-ended questions, mm-hmm. and then we'll wrap it up, because we both have other panels to get to. Ford of Doomsday as televised doesn't have the best reputation in the last DWM survey of Doctor Who stories from Day of the Doctor all the way down to Twin Dilemma and Fear. Does Ford of Doomsday as a television program work for you?
No. No. You know, I think everything comes down to concept and execution. You can have the world's greatest idea, but if you fumble it, no one's going to remember it. You know, they may say, well, that was an interesting idea, and then years later somebody says, wouldn't it be nice if we remade that? And then somebody will say, no, it wasn't a success last time. The accountants won't let us. And then the execution, you know, there are things where the execution's fantastic, you know, because the craftspeople of film and television know what they're doing and they can make extraordinary things, but the script isn't there, you know, it's going to look great, but it's not going to have any substance. So you have to have both, and I don't really think Ford of Doomsday has either. It has great lighting, I'll give it that, great lighting. You know, the cast is doing the best they can with the material, but it's not, you know, it's not going to work because Monarch, at the end of the day, is a shouty, ranting villain with a ludicrous... Saying he has a plot really is giving it a little bit more, you know, more credit than it deserves, because he seems to just be, you know, a millennial tourist coming to Earth, kidnapping people for no readily apparent reason.
With a 30,000-year scheme to poison the Earth.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, he's trying to travel faster than light, you know, to meet God, which he thinks will be himself. If I were God, I'd make it easier on myself. And certainly quicker. So no, I don't think Ford of Doomsday is a particularly engaging Doctor Who adventure.
I think Stratford Johns gives a terrific, underrated, natural, charming performance, considering that he's wearing probably a 2-hour makeup job to make him resemble a frog with a bad case of acne.
Yeah.
And a funny hairdo. I think the scenes between him and Peter Davison, especially in part three, are crackling scenes because you have two terrific actors performing them. On the other hand, the choice to have long dance sequences, I'll give Terrence Dicks the last word on that. In the novelization, Terrence says these dance sequences are interminable. And there's some more of Terrence's editorializing. So let's segue back to the book. We talked earlier that you can see where he's rushing a little bit at the end. Is this a good novelization? Does it hold up today? Did you really enjoy reading it for my podcast?
Terrence Dix did what he could. The one line that I did take out of it that I like is, a mistake that is not acknowledged cannot be corrected. It comes toward the end of the book. It's not a line of dialogue. It's just a nice thought, and it's sort of the piece that I'm going to take away from this. You know, I like to try to find at least one thing to latch on to in everything that I look at. And, you know, he did what he could.
That is the magic of Terrence. He can take a less-than-beloved story, he can write a novelization with memorable turns of phrase that he comes up with himself sitting there in his home because it's not in the camera script or on television. And we're still talking about it 40 years later. So even a book that is not one of Terrence's best still has things that you and I can take away into our own home lives. And that's a wonderful thing.
Yes, certainly. And it's, you know, every part of Doctor Who is fun. Even the parts that we can't laud to the stars have a nostalgia, something to them that makes it worthwhile.
So, for you, who is so well-versed and steeped in science fiction worlds, and you've done lots of work on the universes of X-Files, Babylon 5, and through Harlan Ellison's work, of course, Star Trek and anything else he touched, what is your personal favorite era of Doctor Who, classic series and or new? What is your personal favorite Doctor Who story / script?
Oh, geez. I have to say, I'll just say a period of time, if that will suffice for
you. Of course.
The tenure of Stephen Moffat is what I always wanted Doctor Who to be when I was first discovering the show. I came in when Cartmell was the script editor for the end of the original run. And I really liked what Andrew Cartmell was doing. You know, he was turning a very large boat in what he was trying to accomplish with Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred.
Another transformative figure at Doctor Who. Changed right. The show so completely between seasons 24 and 25.
Yeah, definitely. And in season 25 and 26 were really, they were the newest seasons when I came in. I came in between season 25 and 26, technically. And I saw their first broadcasts on PBS in the U.S. And that was sort of the Doctor Who that I latched onto. And then, to some extent, that Doctor Who, evolved across the 90s in the Virgin New Adventures and then the Eighth Doctor novels. I really latched onto Lawrence Miles. I loved the overall stuff that was happening in the Virgin New Adventures. And then Lawrence Miles tried to do things in the Eighth Doctor adventures, as you and I have talked to offline.
Yes.
He didn't play well with others, and I can understand the frustrations of those around him trying to deal with him coming in and flipping over the chess table every time he wrote one of his books, and then not bothering to tell anybody where the pieces landed.
Yes.
But there was a desire to grab on to the really extraordinary possibilities of Doctor Who. I mean, it's an infinite concept, Well, it's cheap for me to say it's infinite because I don't have to actually produce it. I know there are limitations. I know, God, the poor people who were doing the show in the 80s had limitations, we can't even conceive of because of the way the show was perceived within the BBC. But it has the potential, and potential is something that I value very much, and so much potential goes wasted. It's one of the things I admired about Harlan, was seeing potential in whatever he could, nurturing it. And I think that Lawrence Miles grasped that potential, and I think later Stephen Moffat and the people who were working with Stephen Moffat grasped that potential for that concept. It doesn't always work. I'd rather a swing and a miss than no swing at all. And I think that the Moffat era is kind of the Doctor Who that I dreamed of, coming from Cartmell, coming through the comics and the 90s books. And I'm so happy that I got it, And if Doctor Who never excites me as much as, say, The Day of the Doctor did, or Listen, or I love The Beast Below. I think The Beast Below has some fantastic things to say about our interaction with our government and what we're willing to let pass for our own comfort. I don't think it came off correctly. I don't think the episode itself fulfills the potential and the ideas, but that's the sort of thing that appeals to me, and I'm happy that I had it, and I hope that the people who, feel this way about the Chibnall era, the Russell T. Davis era, any other era of Doctor Who, I hope that they feel like they got the Doctor Who of their dreams at some point.
And Beast Below, it's not the most engaging story to watch, partly because there's budget cuts and it's based on a planet of the indoors and the sets aren't the most striking to look at, but it's a plot that it is in conversation with a particular Ursula Le Guin short story. And anytime you can tie a Doctor Who TV show into a very famous sci-fi work from another writer, you're standing on pretty solid ground.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And it's one of those things where the mechanism is showing too much in that story for it to fully work. You know, you can see the gears and the pieces moving. And I think, you know, maybe had it been placed in a different position in the season, maybe had the pressures of getting that first Matt Smith season off the ground not been what they were, maybe had so much energy not gone into the Angel two-parter produced before.
Right.
You know, a little another polish might have been all that was needed. You know, I don't know. But it's the ideas and the character working together. You know, all the stuff with River Song, the whole setup for that. You know, that's the stuff that appeals to me, the stuff that really uses it. I mean, Stephen used to say that the Doctor Who's a time travel show where they use time travel to get to the story and then leave the story, but they don't do anything with it in the middle. And what I love about his version of Doctor Who is that it so often is there. I mean, going all the way back to continuity references, continuity errors, excuse me, his short story in one of the early... Is it Virgin? Yeah, it's one of the Virgin and
I think
Decalogues.
It was Decalogue 3, I believe.
Yes, Decalogue 3. You know, I mean, it's effectively the template for A Christmas Carol.
Yes.
And you see, at that point, what he thinks the show should be doing. And then you see it again in Curse of the Fatal Death. You know, of Curse of Fatal Death, there's no the there. But, you know, you see it again when he's doing it for comic relief. You see, again, him employing his ideas. And it's just one of those things where to finally get him as the showrunner, you know, I know people have problems with some of the things he did, and I don't disagree in a lot of cases. But it's really going for it. You know, it's tossing your hat over the fence, as it were, and having to you know, to live with the consequences.
My friend Stacy Smith, the Doctor Who nonfiction editor, likes to say Doctor Who can survive being bad, but it can never survive being boring. With Stephen Moffat, Doctor Who was never, ever, ever boring.
I would definitely agree with that.
Well, Jason Davis, where can we find you online?
TheJasonDavis.com. The definite article, you might say.
The original, number one. Thank you so much for your time. This is a great conversation. I hope we get to do this again in the future for another, and perhaps a more detailed and more lavish book than Poor Little Florida Doomsday.
Yes, indeed.
Happy to be joined by Matt West from, I am not sure how to pronounce the name of your publishing house, and I went to Google to figure it out, and yeah. I saw that you helpfully posted it at one time. It's pronounced M-I-W-K.
Yeah.
I've been saying MOOC in my head for years, but I have now finally going to find out, is MOOC the correct pronunciation of MOOC?
I think any pronunciation is correct because it's a made-up word, but it's milk.
It's milk.
I can give you some background to that, but it's kind of excessive. We were recording, we did an extra on the Pyramids of Mars DVD, and Rob had to do the temporary narration for it. And there was a line, I bring Suktek's gift of milk. And every time he said it, it came out like milk. And so since 2003, I registered the domain name so I could have a nice short email address. And I've used it for everything since. So we used it for the publishing and we used it for the shop. So yeah, milk.
If memory serves me right, that was the DVD extra where Suktek has a cat named Neil and calls him Neil, plaything of Suktek.
It's a rabbit, but yes.
Oh, yeah.
we would never have dared try and do it with a cat. That would have been a nightmare. Also, Egyptians wouldn't keep a cat as a pet.
That's true.
Not that I want to overthink this.
No, I've got my cat Smudge right next to me, and longtime listeners of the podcast will know that Smudge is our household god.
I've seen Smudge already. Is Smudge a boy or a girl?
Smudge is a girl.
Girl, yeah. Yeah, my cat is around somewhere, but she's terrified of video calls, so I don't know what it is about the frequency of the microphone or what, but it drives around the bend.
Smudge likes to look at herself on camera. So there have been interviews where she is standing directly in front of me looking at herself on the big screen, and my interviewer can see the cat, but not me. This happens more often than you might think.
Yeah, it happens a lot for me as well. Because my friend's got a cat, and we both watch films of an evening, so our cats end up watching each other.
So we came to each other's attention on Twitter yesterday because I had done a thread about Ford of Doomsday, the novelization. And that's when I discovered that you and Andrew Cartmell had a podcast together, and I have gotten some episodes onto my phone already. So I've downloaded Dirty Harry and Spy Who Loved Me. But since we're doing this interview on very short notice, I have not had a chance to listen yet. I've talked about my podcasting partner, Smudge. What's it like having Andrew Cartmell as a podcast partner?
Oh, he's a nightmare. It's such hard work. We haven't actually recorded anything for nearly a year now. I moved house and we used to record them in his front room together. And then when COVID came in, we started doing them distanced. And it was a huge editing chore because we'd record either end and then I'd mix it later. And we, ever since I moved, he suddenly got, you know, like a 10-book contract. So he's been writing relentlessly. He did a couple of plays. And we are going to start up again soon. But again, the difficult part we're doing with him is finding time to actually get it done. Also, almost every film we discuss, and we are trying to do a film podcast, I nearly always bring up Doctor Who somewhere down the line. Because 9 times out of 10, because of the McCoy era that he worked on, most of the films we're watching will have someone from a McCoy story in it, because the McCoy stories has star-studded casts, much like Fort of Doomsday. Colossal casting, that's great. But yeah, I refer to it way too often. He's very patient with me in that respect. But what I do like is that he can pick apart a problem in a film script so quickly. The logic of a script or just the logic of a conversation, he will immediately pick up on something that should have been rewritten or redone. And quite often there's things I just never realized. Like, because I'm mostly showing him films I love and then he's tearing them apart. But I'm fine with that. I still love them.
Dirty Harry is one of those films my father watched over and over again in the early 80s, which he taped from an out-of-town station on a VCR, but I was only about 9 and 10 years old, so I was deemed too young to watch it. By the time I finally got to see Dirty Harry, I had already seen and memorized The Naked Gun first. And all of a sudden, I realized, wait, The Naked Gun is just a parody of Dirty Harry. I didn't know that in 1988 when the film came out in the theater. So I learned a lot of these things backwards.
Yeah, I was the same with Airport. I saw Airplane long before I saw Airport. And when I finally saw the film, it was spoofing. It was even funnier than Airplane because it had just become so ridiculous. I think that happens to a lot of people.
Yeah. And for those of us who came of age with The Simpsons in 1989, by the time I got to college in the early 90s and finally saw Citizen Kane, wait a minute, this is just 10 Simpsons episodes recorded all in the same movie.
Yeah. It's always nice when you suddenly get a reference many years on, something you've laughed at out of politeness, and then later on you go, oh, that's what the joke is. That happens a lot with me, because there's a lot of adult jokes in films which you've seen as a kid. And it's not until you're older and you think, my God, that joke's filthy. Much like The Simpsons. There's that great line from Smithers where he says to Mr. Burns, he says, really, I don't think women and semen mix. And I don't know how they get away with it. Yeah, there's stuff like that in other films crops up a lot.
Yeah, it's when my daughter was a toddler about 10 years ago, and we were watching Sesame Street. There's an honest-to-God episode of Sesame Street where Elmo starts quoting from the movie Airplane. And Elmo is pretending to be the president of the United States. And he gets a phone call and he goes, headquarters, what is it? And his aide says, it's a big building where generals meet. And I start quoting along with the TV, but that's not important right now. And my kid is like, what are you laughing at?
Man, I mean, you can get away with anything on Sesame Street, but yeah. That is impressive. I'm always amazed at how risky they are with guests on Sesame Street. Like, they have Ron Williams on, who you got to be so careful with that guy. Once he gets going, anything can happen.
Exactly.
There was a kids' TV series over here, a Saturday morning program called Going Live. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson series Bottom, which is a comedy series. It used to go out after 9 p.m., so it was an adult series. But they had them on as guests on this Saturday morning kids program. And it was going fine for about an hour. And then they started to slip. it just becomes the most tense piece of TV you'll see. I love it.
Then there's the famous story about the time that Katy Perry recorded a song with Elmo. So she parodied one of her own songs for Sesame Street. But the outfit that she wore to the recording ended up drawing the ire of conservative parents. So the entire segment had to be scrapped. And it was still available on YouTube as of about 8 or 9 years ago, but they were not allowed to air it because what she was wearing was deemed inappropriate for a show aimed at the toddlers and kindergartners.
One of my favorite spoofs they did was when they had James Blunt on singing about triangles to You're Beautiful. And just, I would love to describe it, but it's better just to seek it out and watch it. I like that everyone's always happy to do anything for Sesame Street. And yet no one watches it anymore. I don't even know what channel it's on. I don't think it's shown over here.
Yeah, it moved over to HBO here in the States.
Oh, okay, so it's locked away.
And of course, now that my kid is going to be a teenager in a matter of days, Sesame Street is long since in our rearview mirror, with the exception of, and I realize this is not the Sesame Street podcast, but I have to get it out there. The Sesame Street Game of Thrones parody is the most wicked, naughty thing I've ever seen, and I have no idea how they got away with it. Have you seen Game of Chairs on Sesame Street?
I'm looking for that immediately after we stop this conversation. I'm going to seek that out.
It is, I'll just give you the broad outlines. It is a game of musical chairs played at Winterfell. Grover is the MC, and then various Game of Thrones characters are playing musical chairs. And as every character is eliminated from the game of musical chairs, Grover makes a reference to that character. And you have to see it to believe it. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But I was laughing out loud with shock that a show aimed at four-year-olds could talk about such things.
I'm intrigued. I need to see this.
Because they're aiming at the parents. The parents are watching next to the kid, and the parents have to be entertained. Which brings us to Fort of Doomsday. I wouldn't say that Fort of Doomsday works on multiple levels the way that Sesame Street does, although I do think that Monarch has some terrific lines, and every time I watch the thing, I'm rooting for Monarch to win as opposed to Adric. But you made a point on Twitter yesterday, which knocked my socks off metaphorically because I wasn't wearing any at the time. You say that Fort of Doomsday has to be cherished because it is the only Peter Davison story.
Yeah, which has no involvement from Eric Saywood at all.
And it's so obvious in retrospect, and I had never thought of that before, but it's true. It's absolutely true.
I think it works to its benefit. I was born in 77, so the 80s are sacred to me. Yeah, that's Doctor Who I grew up with. But most of it's Eric Saywood. In fact, if it's not Saywood, it's Cartmell. So I'm used to stories playing out and then suddenly having a 5-minute TARDIS scene with people shouting at each other in the middle of it for no reason. Because for some reason, Eric Saywood, when he has to extend a script, doesn't extend scenes that are already there. He makes scenes and puts them in the middle, which I suppose it's slightly respectful to the writer, but I think it's also disrespectful because you're pulling the attention away. Kinder's a terrible one for it. I mean, I know they were forced to do the TARDIS scene because the set had been struck by that stage. But yeah, so I have a love-hate relationship with Eric Saywood. I think some of his writing is awful. But some of his choices of scripts to go with are superb. So yeah, but Fort of Doomsday is a script editor script because it's Terence Dudley writing it, and he was a script editor.
Right.
And I think, is it his first Doctor Who? It is his first Doctor Who, isn't it?
He had directed Megalos the year before. I don't know how much input he had into the writing of Megalos, but yes, it was the first of his three full scripts for the program, and it was the only four-parter.
He might have done Canine Company, but just before it.
Oh, yes, he had done. He had done Canine Company, which was used making money that would have made two Peter Davison episodes. So in a sense, it is part of season 19, budget-wise.
Yeah, so he got paid for four.
Yes.
I mean, he did Black Orchid as well that season, which is another one that people, fans have gone against Black Orchid quite a lot lately, I think, because the cast slag it off quite a lot on DVD commentaries and interviews. Davison and Janet Fielding are always so down on that story.
Peter Davison was my first Doctor. I came to the show during reruns of seasons 19 and 20 here in the States. So I love him to pieces, but if you were to choose which Doctor Who stories you like just based upon Peter Davison's commentary, it would be Caves of Androzani, and that's it. You'd have to hate everything else, and I just can't subscribe to that.
The annoying thing with Peter Davison is that he is very, very good at nailing what is wrong with a script or a story or a production. He's always right, and he's a professional. You know, the gulf of difference in production from season 18 to season 19 is noticeable, because you've got a star who is working towards what's best for the program rather than what's best for them that morning, because they're in a really bad mood. And I think it shows in that season 19 especially. I think it really shows. Davison's, you know, the captain of the ship guides everyone else, and I think he led well for that first series. Like, you totally lost interest after that, but that first series especially. Yeah, it's a big difference. And Four to Doomsday, obviously, is his first story in production.
And Four to Doomsday gets criticized a lot. I can't speak for other fans. I think the reason why it gets criticized is because Terence Dudley wasn't quite sure, as a 61-year-old retiree, writing for characters like Egan and Adric are probably things he had no frame of reference for. So much of the story is spent with Tegan and Adric either insulting each other or trying to kill each other, literally, in one scene. And this takes up far too much real estate. While this was the last story not touched by Eric Saywood, it was also the last story to be ever touched by Barry Letts. It was his last thing that he worked on as executive producer, and threw up his hands and said to Anthony Root, "I can't fix this. You'll have to rewrite it." But his problem wasn't the way that Adric and Tegan were portrayed. It was the plotting of Monarch. I think the plotting of Monarch trying to invade Earth is a really solid plot. And I think that even though it's his first time out, Dudley gives Peter Davison a lot to do in part four to save the day, making him a literal action hero. I think these are all positives.
Terence Dudley writes very well, I think, for Davison. For the Fifth Doctor, because he writes in a, because the whole thing with the Fifth Doctor is it's an old man in a young body, and Davison plays that to his strength and actually plays it very grumpy for that first year. Yeah, he's not pleasant, open-faced Doctor. He's actually he's quite cranky, and I like that. And he must God, your cat's terrifying. It's just staring at me.
In her defense, she's looking at herself on screen. She's not looking at you.
Sorry, that was really distracting. Yeah, Terence Dudley, he writes, I think, very well for Doctor Who, but I do know that everyone that's worked with him has not liked him. I was going to say hated him, but I don't think that's entirely true. I think they respect him because the guy's got a great body of work, but I think they find him very difficult to work with because he's quite, he's unmoving. And if he presents a script, that's it done, which is typical of a script editor. You know, I've written this. It's done. It's ready. I would accept it. Doesn't necessarily follow that Anthony Root will accept it, although I don't think Anthony Root gave a damn either way, because he knew he was there temporarily.
Yes.
Has he been interviewed, Anthony Root? I don't know if I've ever seen an interview with him.
That's a very good question. It would only have been on three or four of the season 19 DVDs. And if he has been interviewed, I've completely forgotten it out of my head. Being a little bit older than you, my memory is now at the tipping point. But somebody will be able to fill us in the comments later on.
You're older than me?
I was born a handful of years before you. Put it this way. You were born in 77. One of my defining memories is trying to follow my parents out the door as they were going to see Star Wars in June 1977 at one of the original screens. We lived not too far on Long Island, one of the original May 25th, 1977 Star Wars screens, and they were going. And I tried to follow them out the door while my babysitter was restraining me. I was three going on 4 years old. I probably only had the dimmest idea of what Star Wars even was, but I knew at that age that I had to see a movie called Star Wars. And it wasn't until a few years later that I actually got to see it. So that's my generation.
Okay. I never got to see Star Wars at the cinema until the 90s. So how old were you when season 19 aired in the US?
So the very first Doctor Who story that I ever saw any piece of would have been Time Flight Part 1. And I would have just I watched 90 seconds of it, and I reported back to my friends who told me to watch the show in the first place. This is terrible. I'd rather be watching kids' shows on Nickelodeon, the next channel over on our cable box. And they said, no, you've got to give it a fair chance. So a week later, I went back and I watched Arc of Infinity Part 2. That was my first cliffhanger. That was what drew me in, Arc of Infinity, yeah. Which also is comical considering how Arc of Infinity doesn't rank too far above Port of Doomsday in fandom popularity contest. But for me, it's part of my Doctor Who DNA. I will never hear a bad word about Arc of Infinity.
I think it's a first story thing. I think that was a lot of what it comes down to, because the full story I can remember, the first full story, is Keeper of Traken. And people aren't terribly keen on that either. But I'll sit and watch
this
it.
This is a Keeper of Traken house you're talking to right here. So I will talk to you Keeper of Traken all day long. But you were saying...
I think... Oh, no, it's in another room. I thought I had an Andrew Skilleter painting up there, but I haven't. Yeah, I think the first story, the first Doctor that you encounter is always going to be your favourite. And it holds like a little special place. But you had the other thing over here, especially, in that there were never any repeats. So, well, there were by this stage, by the 80s, but for the most part, there were very rarely repeats of Doctor Who until the sort of mid-90s. So unless you'd tape them off air or you had pirate copies, the only way you could get them was to buy them on VHS. They're about four stories out. But they were so expensive to buy back then that you could rent them from the video rental place. And there were six video rental places near me, and each of them had a different Doctor Who story. So one had Terror of the Zygons, one had Pyramids of Mars, one had Revenge of the Cybermen. So depending what mood I was in, I'd have to cycle a different distance to rent a different story to watch it again. And those four, five stories that first came out on VHS, like Day of the Daleks, Death to the Daleks, I'll watch them all day long, any day. And I know Day of the Daleks is awful, but I will always watch it because it's got that connection. And the same goes with season 19. Fort Doomsday, Time Flight, Black Orchid, visually, I just remember them so well. And that Roger Limb soundtrack, not even my favourite composer for Doctor Who, but the sound is just pure Davison. So, yeah, it's such a lovely era. And I don't know why people don't like Fort Doomsday. I think the problem with it is that it's not a kid's story. It's more of a grown-up story. I think for kids, all the jumping around, the dancing, the play fights, and there's no connection for them because you've got Adric is meant to be there as like the connection for the kids. Well, that was the idea. But he's so obnoxious and arrogant, especially when Terence Dudley's riding him.
Yes.
As you say, you end up rooting for Monarch because why would you want Adric to have anything good? And the same goes for Tegan as well. Tegan is bipolar in this story. You know, one minute she's lovely and pleasant when she's chatting with Monarch and she's sketching beautiful drawings of 80s clothing. And the next minute she's having a proper full-on breakdown in the TARDIS for no readily apparent reason other than to give us a third episode.
Terence Dix in the novelization, and I'll be reading the quotes out from that elsewhere on this episode. Terence Dix in the novelization clearly does not understand two things. Number one, why is Tegan being written so badly? And number two, why does a 90-minute Doctor Who serial need to have seven different dance sequences in it? So the adjectives that Terence uses to describe those two things are Terence at his most shade throwing. Terence is like, I don't understand what has happened to my Doctor Who.
Well, looking back, and when I watch the story now, I really appreciate those dance sequences for what they achieved in the studio and what they're trying to convey. And the trouble is, it's very difficult to convey entertainment on a long flight. You know, you can't afford it. If you wanted proper entertainment, you would have a bigger budget, you'd have more going on. but they can only afford a few dancers. That's the best they're going to manage in a studio recording for, what, 8 hours of an evening. That's the best you're going to get. You're not going to get stand-up or anything like that. Dance is the cheapest way of doing this. And even then, what I love is they didn't even hire dancers, did they? The dragon was all the guys from the local Chinese takeaway.
That's right, that's right.
Yeah. Cracks me up. That's so John Nathan Turner. they had the same problem with Mordrin Undead the next year, where they've got an eternal flight and the only entertainment is one little Atari video game. It's budget. It happens in Terror of the Vervoids as well. Long flight, just a crappy Atari video game, which looks almost the same as one from Never Say Never Again.
That's right. With Klaus Maria Brandauer playing against Sean Connery.
Yeah. I think we've recorded a Never Say Never Again podcast. I don't think we've actually put it out there yet.
The first Bond that I was old enough to see in the theaters was Octopussy, so I would have seen that when it came out in early 83. So my second Bond in the theater would have been Never Say Never Again. My father wouldn't have known about the fight between Eon and Kevin McClory. We thought it was a proper Bond film. We didn't realize it was basically an off-license parody. So I hated Never Say Never Again in the theater. The only part that I enjoyed was that video game sequence being about 10 years old.
I really like Never Say Never Again. Just from the point of view, it's much like Fall to Doomsday is like, the only thing that Sayward's not involved in. It's the only Bond film made by a different production company that is meant to be a proper Bond film. And it's interesting to see how they approach it and what they do differently. I think it works as a curio. I think if they were to have done Warhead as well and remade it a third time, it would have been a nightmare.
Having Pamela Salem in the James Bond universe is always going to be a good thing. So say we Doctor Who fans. She is the nexus point between the Andrew Cartmell era and the James Bond universe.
There must be another actor in that film that's in Doctor Who. Does Rowan Atkinson count?
I will count Rowan Atkinson.
Brilliant. Well, let's quit while we're ahead because I can't think of us.
oh my goodness. So we'll just give Four to Doomsday the last word here. I think Monarch has some terrific, terrific dialogue. It's basically Stratford Johns in heavy makeup sitting in a chair for all but two scenes out of the story. So if Stratford Johns is on set for six studio days, he is sitting in a chair for maybe 8 hours a day for almost every single day of that shoot. But I think it works. He is a compelling figure based on the dialogue he's given and the way he delivers it. Even though it's just a guy in a frog mask sitting in a chair, it shouldn't work, but I think it really does. And he has to get a lot of the credit for that.
Well, you need some context because Stratford Johns was a really big name, but he was very well known for Zed cars. I think it was Zed cars. He might have been Softly Softly as well. I don't know. It's not really my area, but everyone knew him for that. So the opportunity to do a role in a series where he was covered up, disguised, and having a bit of fun was just irresistible to him. And I think it shows. But you saying earlier about Barry Letts not knowing how to handle Monarch or how to reason it. All of Barry Letts' villains are big, shouty villains. Yeah, you've got your Stephen Thorne voice bellowing.
Right.
It's a different type of Doctor Who. And, different eras have different styles. And we're now into the quiet villain period. You've just had Melka, who's just that mellifluous voice. It's nice and calm. You've got Anthony Ainley's Master, who I don't think ever shouts. It's always softly spoken. And Monarch as well. There's a thing with Terence Dudley's writing. It's all very gentlemanly and English. Black Orchid is very polite and pleasant. Even the arguments between the companions in Black Orchid and Four to Doomsday are polite. They're not screaming matches like you get later on. It's Davison sort of wanders in and says, "Oh, Adric's just showing off. It's this." Adric's just trying to wind Tegan up with his knowledge and Nyssa's reading a book on mathematics. It's all very nice. It's pleasant. And I kind of like that. Whereas Sayward's stuff is gritty and unpleasant, I would say. He always, especially in the stuff he writes himself, he's always looking for that gritty. I suppose you need conflict. But I think Terence Dudley's script proved that conflict doesn't necessarily have to be unpleasant. You can just bicker rather than argue.
And in Florida Doomsday, at least the fight between Adric and Tegan is organic to the plot, whereas the next story on Kinda, there is that 5-minute sequence in the dome, which was, I think it was the same director, Peter Grimway, done on Earthshock, which would have been a couple of months later. They had to go back in time. But that's just 5 minutes of them arguing because the script was underrunning by 5 minutes. And that, I think, is almost the legacy of the Sayward era, these long padding scenes which have no displacement on the plot. At least in Florida Doomsday, that fight moves things along, being charitable.
Well, I mean, Sayward's stuff always seems to, scripts from his era always seem to be underwritten, and the Cartmell stuff is always overwritten. And I don't know if it's better to be throwing material away, because when you look at something like Ghostlight, you think, well, maybe we should have kept some of this in.
Right.
And then you look at the Davison era especially, and there are some stories, like, I mean, I don't understand Awakening's reputation at all. I don't see a story there, and it just feels to me like it's two episodes too long as it is. But, yeah, every story has a fan. And yeah, there's always someone out there that loves a story. And it annoys me that Florida Doomsday always comes so low in season polls. Although, weirdly, I think at the time, Kinda came bottom of the season poll.
Somebody was discussing that on my show a while back. I don't have access to the DWMs, but I think you're right, because Kinda is not, on its surface, a story that's going to appeal to a certain age group, because it's all cerebral. And when there finally is a plot happening, it's a poorly realized papier-mâché snake.
I don't know. I've got a real soft spot for Kinder as well. You may have noticed season 19 is my little favorite, but yeah, I can see through those things. If it's a good script and there's some good dialogue in there, and there's some cracking dialogue in Kinder and some really good ideas, it's weird. You've just got season 18 suddenly kickstarts these very thoughtful stories. You've got things like Warrior's Gate, Kinder, I got another one. I can't think what the other one is I'm trying to think of, but suddenly Doctor Who isn't about arrive, overthrow the government, leave. There's a weirdness to it, or as JNT used to call them, the oddball story. And I like that he kept the oddball stories going.
I am a vocal defender of Castor Valva, which I've already covered on this program. And Castor Valva is two episodes of very strange figures created by the Master to distract the Doctor, having witty dialogue. So the three male leads in Castor Valva, I am inordinately fond of. And Florida Doomsday, Kinda, if memory serves me right, part one of Kinda was the last thing script edited by Binmead before his contract expired. And then the rest of Kinda was script edited by Sayward. So there is a sort of drop in quality between parts one and the rest, as Sayward's ideas for the story take over Binmead's and Christopher Bailey's idea for the story.
I would imagine that with Kinda, I know that it was commissioned by Binmead originally, but I would imagine that all four episodes were Sayward, because he took a very long time to get back to Christopher Bailey, and then it was all last minute rewrite. So it's possible that, I suppose, episode one is always your setup, and then you've got to resolve everything later on. So that may be why there's a disparity between them. But I would be very surprised if any of Binmead's stuff survived, because he was out of the picture. He wrote Castor Valva, and then Anthony Root had taken over by that stage. And then Visitation would have been in production. And then Kinda would have been done. Is that the order? I think it is.
My memory comes from having watched the DVD text commentary to Kinda several years ago. And I believe that's where I learned that Binmead had a lot of involvement in part one. Whether it was the outline for part one that he structured or the script itself, I no longer recall. Now, the Kinda episode is about a month from now on this show, so I'll solve it by then. But I do have a recollection that Binmead had a lot more to do with Kinda part one than anything else in that season outside of Castor Valva.
Right. Are you doing season 19 in sequence?
Going in publication order for the novelization. So we've already done the Visitation.
Ooh. Right.
And then we did Castor Valva. So this is the third Davison novelization, but it's the first one done by Terence Dix.
Right.
And then the last one, of course, is going to be Black Orchid, which was the final Davison novelization, at which point Terence Dudley had forgotten which order his own stories came out. So the Black Orchid novelization, rather famously, contains a continuity reference to the King's Demons, which had not happened yet. And when it did happen, would have different companions in it. So It doesn't quite work, but that's Terence Dudley for you.
I remember Black Orchid being a really good book.
He adds a lot. He adds a lot of scenes, and he adds a lot of environment and texture to Black Orchid. And King's Demons, he entirely rewrites the plot. So the last couple of chapters of King's Demon is almost part three to the TV story. None of it happens on screen, but it's wonderful to see Dudley expanding King's Demons into a full-size novelization.
I think he may be one of the first authors to do that.
If you don't count Malcolm Hulk, almost certainly. All right, we are just about out of time on the Zoom recording. Yeah. Matt West, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to talk to myself. And now Smudge is blocking me, so you're talking to Smudge rather than me, but I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you for asking. And good luck with it.
Have a great night.
Cheers, man.
As we continue our most technically complex episode of Doctor Who literature ever recorded, I am joined 3 months later and in a different time zone by Jason Davis. Jason, welcome back to the show, even though we've heard you in audience terms only about 40 minutes ago.
Thank you for allowing me to become a complex space-time event.
So thanks to you in part, I did land the interview with Matt West. We heard that a little bit earlier. And then after playing back my interview with Matt and my interview with you from back in February in a much noisier room than the one I'm recording in now, I realized that I've been making a lot of the same points about Ford of Doomsday over and over again. So I've trimmed down my audio essay considerably. Otherwise, I would have been making the same points in three different segments of this program, which is a little too verbose, even for me. I wanted to give you a chance to address anything else about Ford of Doomsday we did not get to do in a crowded hallway at the LAX Marriott back in February.
Well, first off, I'd like to apologize to Richard Bignall because I referred to Richard Molesworth when I was discussing the production subtitles in the hallway at Gallifrey One. So it was Richard Bignall, not Richard Molesworth, that gave me some input on those on Twitter.
It's a fair mistake because Richard Molesworth did a lot of those text commentaries in the early days.
Yeah, but it was Bignall who was actually telling me some stuff that I used when we were discussing Ford of Doomsday, although I don't remember at this point if he did the text commentary on Ford of Doomsday. So that's neither here nor there. I just wanted to correct my mistake. I hate being wrong, but I love being corrected. what I thought was interesting was that, Matt West came in on Twitter and you were discussing Ford of Doomsday with him. And what he said on Twitter that actually prompted me to want to come back was the fact that not only was Ford of Doomsday the only Davison era episodes not touched by Eric Sayward, but they were also effectively a Hartnell story told in season 19, which he didn't bring up. He mentioned that on Twitter, but didn't bring it up during your interview. And when he said that on Twitter, it all clicked in my mind. I was like, yeah, it's definitely a season one first production block Hartnell story.
And that is something I love about the Hartnell era. Now, most of the Hartnell era had not been novelized by the summer of 1983 when this book comes out. So we haven't really talked about that trope that much on this show. We certainly will in the years to come. But the Hartnell era, again, you're recording primarily in Lime Grove D, which is not too much bigger than the dining room that I'm recording from right now in a small Brooklyn apartment. You have the cast walking across the studio slowly, narrating every inch of the scenery and props. And that is a particular style of storytelling that I love. If you watch episode one of The Reign of Terror, which I happen to love out of proportion to the way that Reign of Terror is received on the usual rankings, all of that could now be done in 3 minutes as a cold open for the new series. You don't need to spend 25 minutes walking across a studio forest to get to the studio barn set. I like that kind of storytelling. I like that it gives the characters room to breathe and talk to each other, and you're not rushing towards the opening credits.
I kind of find myself wondering, had Terence Dudley looked at Doctor Who, in the last 19 years when he came to do Ford of Doomsday, because, he was one of the people who was consulted early on when Verity was in charge. There was a
possibility that he might take a pass at Anthony Coburn's Serial A scripts. And, you know, but I don't think he ever did. I think it was discussed at one point, but never actually happened. And I wonder if Doctor Who, as it existed at that time, was fixed in his mind in that form, you know, with a elderly man, three companions, and then he shows up and there are three companions. And Peter Davison is, as was remarked upon in your previous interview, playing an elderly doctor in a young body. And it's, there's a certain level of I'm struggling to come up with a term for it. I should have thought of this before we talked, but it's like the Censorites. That's what it reminds me of. There's something about the Censorites in that it has, you know, some lovely, there's some lovely aspects of that serial. But if you were to dig too deeply into the Censorite culture, you would have a lot of problems. And I think the portrayal of the Censorite culture has the same sort of conceptual density, if I can coin a term, as Monarch's plan. And maybe, you know, maybe Terence Dudley and Peter R. Newman are so beyond my conception that they have conceived aliens that are not perceptible to my ability to understand their reasoning. Or maybe they just didn't think it through and the aliens come off as particularly weird because a human can't understand them because nobody can understand them. Either way, it's the same sort of thing. The way the Censorite culture works, the way Monarch's plan works. That's what I was thinking about when Matt made his comment about the season one, the first Doctor-ness of it all.
Monarch's plan does defy
all
a lot of logical exploration. Yeah, I'm being a little more circumspect about it than you are, but of course, Monarch is also insane, as we learned, so that could be shorthand for why his plan makes no sense. I want to defend the Censorites, though, because I happen to enjoy the Censorites, and I realize I may be alone on this ship.
No.
If you look at the first season of Doctor Who, which the first production block goes from Unearthly through Dalek Invasion of Earth, there's really only two alien species, Daleks and Censorites.
Mm-hmm.
I don't include the Vord, because we don't know if the Vord are aliens or if they're just citizens of Marinus wearing funny hats.
Right.
The Daleks are fascist robots. They're Terry Nation's way of fighting World War II and defeating the Nazis again. That's terrific.
Right.
The Censorites are philosophical monsters who are scared of the dark. I think that's a pretty neat concept, and it's not something that Doctor Who would explore that much in later years until you get to the Ood, who are the Censorites 2.0 and even are acknledged as such on screen.
Right. Yeah. I can definitely see that. It's been forever since I've seen the Censorites. It's been a decade at least since I've watched it. But I remember at the time being slightly disturbed that one Censorite could confuse another one by changing his clothing.
There is a defense for that, which is that the Censorites are telepathic, so they're going to recognize each other by brainwaves more than by physical appearance. Although even that falls apart a little bit later on. But that's my headcanon for justifying that.
and if that works, great, you know. And I don't dislike the Censorites, you know. It's not ever going to be on my top 10 list, let's put it that way, or my top 150 list, but you know, it's an interesting, you know. And that's the thing about Doctor Who, is even ones that I don't particularly like, I find interesting. I mean, one of my I think I got along these lines when we talked before, but I have a quote now, so somebody cleverer than I can express it better than I did, which is, I like interesting failures better than works where the artist always knows exactly what he's doing. And that was Carol Imschwiller, the SF writer. And that very much encapsulates my, you know, my feelings about Doctor Who. I'd rather a Doctor Who try something completely outré and bizarre and fall flat on its face than just be, you know, a banal hour of television or 30 minutes of television, whichever.
And Monarch is a villain who spends most of his time watching the events unfold on television. So it's almost, I don't know if this was meant as a meta commentary on TV viewers, the way that Vengeance on Varos would be a few years later, but that's basically what Monarch is.
Yeah, interesting point there. Yeah, I mean, obviously with Vengeance, it's the intent, whereas with Monarch, it may just be, you know, I don't know. Again, trying to figure out what Terence Dudley is thinking, trying to figure out what Terence Dudley came to Doctor Who with. you know, as far, because he'd been producing shows. I guess he directed Megalos the year before.
Which is a story where the Doctor doesn't exit the TARDIS until the very end of part two. So that's also part of his frame of reference, where the characters don't join the main action until a very long time has gone by.
Yeah, and it's written by two guys who are new to Doctor Who, so he's not doing a Robert Holmes or a Terence Dick script, which would have shown a greater familiarity with the format as a whole, and the more traditional way of handling things. Speaking of Megalos, I'm distressed that Terence used the open face for the human in Megalos before he used it in Fort of Doomsday, thus undermining my whole reason for choosing Fort of Doomsday over Earthshock when we did this in the first place.
True, but that was Terence workshopping. This is him, Terence, bringing it up to the big league. So you're still getting the first canonical appearance of that line as it relates to the Doctor rather than an unnamed extra.
But I was unaware of the previous usage, and it sort of took me by surprise when I listened to your episode. I hadn't read Megalos before, so.
I also want, well, based on my download numbers, most folks have not read Megalos, one of my least popular episodes ever.
Ouch.
I want to point out, while we're on the subject of author quotes, today happens to be Harlan Ellison's birthday.
Yep, 89.
89. I was reading David Gerrold's book recently on the making of Trouble with Tribbles, and there was a very good quote about Harlan Ellison in there, which I don't have at hand. But it's about how he enjoyed dealing with Harlan as long as it was in very small doses.
That changed years later, I'm sure. I don't remember how long after making the Trouble with Tribbles he wrote that book.
I believe it would have been early 70s, because Gerald did a couple of very entertaining Star Trek nonfiction books in the early 70s, and I got the ebook edition, which came out about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But this was young David Gerald writing, I should say.
Yeah. I've been thinking about Harlan all day, as I always do on this day of the year. Sometimes I managed to put out new books on his birthday. Sometimes I was running too far behind and they weren't ready to go. But there's still an urgency to release a Harlan Ellison book when I see May 27th coming up on the calendar, even though it's not my particular bailiwick anymore. I have been thinking about him today. I think about him most days, but, you know.
Now, you have already heard the edited version of our Gallifrey interview where I was musing during an interstitial why I didn't ask you what Harlan thought of modern day Doctor Who, because he was watching, as you say, up until he passed away, the Moffat era. Do you happen to know of any of his particular reflections on any of the modern day stories?
One second here. Bear with me for a moment. I want to get the quote that he used, because I think we discussed the quote when we talked previously, and I didn't have it to hand.
We discussed the quote over email, but of course I do not release all my emails into podcast form.
No, that would be a most unusual approach. Harlan, after watching The Name of the Doctor, I was over there. I want to say that was around this time of year because I think it was May or June of 2013.
That was the day that I was going to go watch a public screening of that at the Way Station, which is in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn, maybe a 20-25 minute walk from where I live. And I was going to go, and I got lazy and I didn't go, and I watched it on Sci-Fi Channel instead, or wherever, BBC America.
BBC America.
And it turns out that Stephen Moffat and Matt Smith went to the Way Station that very night to watch the show with their fans, and I just missed meeting them because I was too lazy to walk across Prospect Park.
Oh, a good friend of mine works in Prospect Park, as it happens. Anyway, a good friend of Harlan's as well. The quote from Don Marquis, creator of Archie and Mehitabel, is, "If you make people think they're thinking, they'll love you. But if you really make them think, they'll hate you." And that is what Harlan said to me when we were discussing The Name of the Doctor, probably it would have broadcast on a Saturday, so the following Wednesday. That was traditionally my day of going over there. And that's what he said. And I said, yeah, I think you're not too far off in that assessment. So that was it. You know, that was his succinct way of saying what he thought of Moffat's level of narrative complexity, I think.
That really hits the nail on the head. I happen to love name of the Doctor because of the big reveal at the end. But if you were to give me a pen and paper and ask me to write down what happened before John Hurt shows up, even after having seen the thing last year, I would be hard-pressed to explain what it's all about until the grand finale.
It's all teeing up for the Day of the Doctor, really.
A 45-minute prologue.
Yeah, and almost an epilogue to the two great intelligence stories from earlier in the season.
True, it is the last appearance of Richard E. Grant on Doctor Who for the time being.
Yeah, it's an interesting piece. Just the shape of it is peculiar because it's filling in an unusual hole in the overarching narrative, and so it's wrapping up the great intelligence stuff, queuing up the War Doctor stuff, and just occupying an odd shape. Really, I mean, it's not a traditional episode; it's very transitional.
It also wraps up the Clara Impossible Girl arc because Clara had a different plot function on each of her three Doctor Who seasons. So she starts off as the Impossible Girl. This explains why. After she jumps into the strange glowing vortex, she finds herself splintered in time and winds up interacting with the Doctor in every single adventure that the Doctor has ever had. New low-res footage of Clara running across the Aztecs and running across the three Doctors, which is a question that I really should ask on every episode of this program. What would Clara have done in Arc of... I'll say that again. What would Clara have done in Florida Doomsday, this story, to save the day and help the Doctor out? So we know that Clara is somewhere in the background of the story, thanks to the name of the Doctor.
Oh, she's obviously in the dragon.
Of course. The very thing.
Yeah.
I just happen to love the Hartnell narrative style, though. I like the TARDIS arrives, they open the doors, they walk outside, they explore, they meet somebody, they're drawn into the plot, they solve the plot, they leave. Having been watching Doctor Who since the 1980s, that's still my default take on the program. And the new series doesn't have to do that because now it's filmed in a much more cinematic way with a different budget and lots more visual effects. You don't have to spend 20 minutes explaining what... You don't have to spend 20 minutes like the Sensorites does explaining how to open a door on a spaceship. We all not take that as shorthand. I just happen to like the slower, gentler way of doing things. And Florida Doomsday does give us that.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's great that you can appreciate the historical reasons behind why it needs to be structured the way it's structured. You know, it's Doctor Who is a lovely, lovely evolution of television. You know, the only other show I can think of that does it almost as well is The Avengers, because The Avengers starts live to tape, moves to videotape, you know, and then broadcast after the fact, then moves to film. So it does the entire, you know, scope of television evolution across the 60s. Doctor Who, because of its 60-year scope, gives you not only changes in technology, because, I mean, technically, aside from the McGann movie, there really isn't any filmed Doctor Who, per se. You know, there's... You get the change in narrative style, and not only the change in narrative style, but specifically the change in British narrative style. Because, as you say, you have to fill the time as you walk from one side of the studio to the other because cutting the tape costs money.
Right.
And the BBC engineering department will, you know, send you a fine if you've done it three times. And so there's that angle of it. And while I appreciate the way it was in the past, I'm very much of the opinion that, you know, you always have to move forward in how you present things. I mean, my biggest problem when they revived the X-Files 4 or 5 years ago was that it felt like they were trying to do 90s television in the 2010s.
Right.
And the show hadn't moved along. Whereas, you know, the other side of that coin is Twin Peaks, which when they brought it back on Showtime in 2017 was so utterly beyond what happened in 1990 and 91 on ABC, that you could very easily watch it, and aside from seeing the actors that you recognize, you wouldn't know it was the same show. Because it had, David Lynch's approach to narrative has moved on, and it uses the things that he developed in Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire to tell the story. So
you and I are both big fans of Better Call Saul. One of the narrative tricks that I love on Better Call Saul is it's a time travel show taking place in multiple time zones.
Right.
But the future is what's black and white.
Yeah. Yeah. And they backed themselves into ending the series in black and white, which I thought was very bold thing to do in 2022 or 21.
And they brought back Carol Burnett for a major role. After Carol Burnett had been mentioned as Carol Burnett in an earlier episode, they bring her in to play a different character who's important to the ongoing story arc of Saul being brought to justice. Carol Burnett, one of the last surviving stars of an original 1959 to 1964 Twilight Zone. There's only a handful of surviving episode headliners, and she's one of them. Yeah. And here she is still making black and white TV in the 2020s, and it's as amazing now as Twilight Zone was back then. I don't know if you've seen this. I came across my Twitter feed recently, one of the Twilight Zone Twitter accounts that I follow. So there's this very, very well-known Twilight Zone episode from the early 60s, the middle of the program, called The Hunt. And it's an Earl Hamner script, the years before Earl Hamner went and created The Waltons. Uh-huh. And it's about the old man who's going hunting with his dog, and he drowns, and he wakes up and is in the afterlife, and he comes across what he believes are the gates of heaven, and he's not allowed inside, or his dog is not allowed inside, and he decides to leave, and then it turns out he wasn't actually at the gates of heaven after all. What I wouldn't have known is that Earl Hamner had already sold that script a decade earlier, and it was produced in a New York City studio for Kate Smith's TV program in the early 50s, and it's only half the length. So all the entire first half of the show, where you're introduced to the old man and his dog and the old man's wife, and you see the old man drown, this is only act two. And it's the old man waking up in front of the gates of heaven. And then the actor who plays the literal angel who shows up to rescue our hero at the end is played by, as Kate Smith calls him, Jimmy Dean, or as we know him better now, James Dean, right before he did his few movies and died very, very young.
Yep. It's funny that you mentioned that episode of all episodes of The Twilight Zone. I went to a reading of that script by Earl Hamner and the actor Robert Donner, probably best known as Exidor from Mork and Mindy.
Oh, wow.
And they performed it live, and it was promoting Earl's book of Twilight Zone scripts. So I have his script book signed by both gentlemen, and saw them perform that episode live as a two-hander.
Which roles did Earl perform?
Now that you mention it, it was Bob Donner was the hunter and Earl was pretty much everybody else.
Oh, so Earl played both the angel and the gatekeeper to the other place.
Right. Exactly.
That's amazing. Well, I did not know that. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. It's a great book. I don't know if it's still in print at this point. And then I met Earl again a few years later at an event for Richard Matheson. So there was Earl was there and Rockne O'Bannon from the new Twilight Zone series, later creator of Farscape and Alien Nation. Yes. And also George Clayton Johnson, who was ubiquitous for my first several years here. I saw George Clayton Johnson many times.
Then we should point out that George R.R. Martin got his start on the 1985 Twilight Zone and wrote a very good first season script, which starred Norman Lloyd, who lived to be about 106.
Yes.
And also starred a very, very, very young John Cameron Mitchell years before Broadway.
Oh, really? I didn't realize John Cameron Mitchell was in that. Wow.
Norman Lloyd acquires a young leather-clad sidekick who was played by a very young, preternaturally young John Cameron Mitchell, who's now a retiree in his 60s. But back then, he was a young 20-year-old man in a leather jacket.
Fascinating. I'll have to look at that again. And George R. R. Martin, of course, took the post vacated by Harlan when he left over the Deadly Knackles affair.
Ed Asner in a Christmas special. And
yes,
as Harlan put it somewhere on the DVD commentaries, he quit the show because CBS wouldn't produce it because they didn't want to offend the fascists or offend the Nazis.
Yes. Who's going to offend? Racists was the line in question. Yeah. And they were in pre-production. It was contract signed. Harlan was going to direct it. Asner had been signed. Costume fittings, all that stuff, and they pulled the plug within 48 hours of shooting starting. It was not well out in advance. It was a last minute thing.
And this leads to an odd circumstance where they have to do a replacement because it was three segments to the hour and they were all supposed to be Christmas themed.
Right.
And they end up having to write a segment or pull a segment out of the can starring Pam Dauber, speaking of Mork and Mindy. And it's not a Christmas story at all, except somebody struck Christmas lights across the office set where she's working, and that makes it vaguely Christmas themed, but not nearly as much as the Knackles would have been.
Right. Yeah. It's these things happen, and Harlan, they lost Harlan over it, which is just terrible because he had a couple more scripts in development. So there would have been more Ellison adaptations that would have been worth seeing.
And there was one more that he came back and wrote for the third syndicated season of New Twilight right. Zone, which that's one of the ones I have never seen, by the way. I have the DVDs, but I haven't gotten that far.
Crazy as a Soup Sandwich.
Yes. And who stars in that one?
Anthony Franciosa, who was also on, he guest starred on one of the shows Harlan wrote in the 60s. And I cannot remember which one it was at the moment. It may have been a Burke's Law. But that was a reunion of sorts, I suppose. And also the script editor on that season of The Twilight Zone was J. Michael Straczynski, later creator of Babylon 5, where Harlan Ellison was conceptual consultant.
So. Yes, and you, as you told us earlier in this program, or in our case back in February, that you have done Babylon 5 books.
Yes, yes, yes. That is that and Harlan Ellison are the sort of two poles of my existence, professionally speaking. And, well, they're not too terribly far apart. They kind of overlap. Those are my two worlds. I've been working on a book on the making of Babylon 5 for several years now. It's funny that obviously the audience doesn't know that I had difficulty getting on this call today. I was having some audio issues, but I use this very software you're using every day to interview people from Babylon 5. So it's fascinating to me that it failed me in the middle of the afternoon. So
I am literally occupying the place on your monitor where Bruce Boxleitner could conceivably have been a couple of days ago.
Very possibly. Very possibly.
Or Walter Koenig.
Very possibly. I don't reveal who I've interviewed yet because I want people to be surprised when they read the book, because I'm on interview 153 as of yesterday for this project. And some people I tell, you know, I spoke to so-and-so today. I'll tell the people who supported my project. But I have a couple of them that I just want people to turn the page, read the name, and say, oh my God, he talked to so-and-so? Because I'm not talking to the regular people that most making of books talk to. You know, it's speaking of Twilight Zone, you know, one of the books I really admire is The Twilight Zone Companion by Mark Scott Zickrey, also a Babylon 5 writer.
Yes.
But he started out doing that Twilight Zone book early on, and he spoke to so many people at the tail end of when you could really speak to those people, because they started, you know, he was doing it in the 70s, so Twilight Zone was already 20 years in the past.
And he puts the audio recordings of those interviews on the DVD and now the Blu-ray sets. I've got to get back to my yes. Twilight Zone pilgrimage. I've stalled out towards the end of season two, but his contributions to that, I actually got to meet him at Galley right before the pandemic, and I got the latest version of Twilight Zone Companion. I think I now own 4 copies of that.
Yes,
every single one is worth the expense.
I did a Babylon 5 panel with him at that Gallifrey one.
Oh, wow. And that was before you and I had met.
Yes. Yes, I was actually trying to launch my Babylon 5 book at that Gallifrey one, and something came up in my wife's personal life that forced us to postpone it at the time, and it ended up being launched a couple months later. But I had planned to launch it there with the Babylon 5 cast. So,
no, meeting him was as exciting for me as it must have been for him to meet Burgess Meredith when he was working on that book back in the 70s, because I spent so much of my youth reading Twilight Zone Companion over and over. I discovered that in Doctor Who pretty much at about the same time. So those are that and Star Trek are the three pillars of my early, I guess, no, that and Star Trek and Star Wars. I'll point out that when you were messaging me that you were trying to get on Zoom, you said almost there, and I immediately supplied the line "stay on target," which you immediately recognized as a Star Wars quote.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was setting you up for it. I when I said almost there, I was hearing it in the correct voice. and I was going to actually, when you then said, since we were talking about novelizations, it should be Blue Leader, I was going to make the point that if you haven't read it, you should check out Alan Dean Foster's very good memoir of writing novelizations, which opens pretty much with Star Wars. There are a few before it, but it opens with Star Wars. It's a fascinating glimpse at the world of writing novelizations, which is, you know, a very niche subject that really, you know, only he and Terrence could probably tackle with authority. Maybe Peter David.
Yes. And Terrence never did write a memoir of the craft, but I'll have to find out that. I'll have to seek out that Alan Dean Foster book.
Yes. The director should have killed you, shot you, something like that. The director should have either killed or shot. I can't remember which. Published by Centipede Press.
Centipede Press. Speaking of Zoom, we are running out of my Zoom recording time, so I am going to take us out. But let's say one last word about poor old Florida Doomsday after having segued through every other American sci-fi franchise for the last 60 years. So Florida Doomsday is probably not a story you watch for fun or for comfort. There's never been a time when I've watched the story that I've actively hated it. I think its heart is in the right place, and I have problems with the way that Tegan and Adric are portrayed.
Yeah.
It's not the only story of the Davison era to misuse the talents of those two, so it's not really a reason to hate on Florida Doomsday while sparing everything else. I just think it's a good effort. Not every Doctor Who story is going to be a Pyramids of Mars or a Curse of Fenric. It's important to have these good, fair to middling stories in the middle, because you're not only going to be watching the classics.
I would agree with that. I mean, you know, not everything can be a home run, to use your favorite pastime.
Yes.
You know, I mean, not everything can be a grand slam. Oh, look at me. I've used two baseball terms in a row. It's fantastic. I'll have to write my mother. but yeah, I mean, I like to think that, sirens in the distance. They're coming for me. I like to think that everybody tries to do their best. You know, that's one of the things that I've taken away from doing this Babylon 5 book, is I've spoken to people in every department. And, you know, the thing that comes across is everybody is doing their best. They're working at the top of their game to make a TV show come out. And, you know, sometimes it just doesn't quite work. You know, we spoke previously about The Beast Below, which I think has a great premise and a really hefty philosophical weight behind it. But it just doesn't quite gel for any number of reasons. You know, maybe it was just because everybody was exhausted after doing the Angel two-parter in the 11th hour. I don't know, you know. But it's, you know, everybody's trying to do the best they can. Everybody's trying to turn out something extraordinary, and sometimes they fall short of the plate. And Florida Doomsday is a marvelous way to spend 90 minutes. I remember watching it for the first time and thinking, well, it's fantastic. It's a new Doctor Who. It's a new Doctor Who. There's nothing better than new Doctor Who.
That is a perfect way to take us out. Jason Davis, thank you so much for joining me 3 months later. We are going to have you back on this program, and I look forward to speaking to you again, my friend.
Good. Thank you for having me. I look forward to my return.
Doctor Who, Florida Doomsday, by Terence Dix. Televised as Florida Doomsday. Teleplay by Terence Dudley. Televised January 1982. Paperback release date July 21st, 1983. Target book number 77. When the TARDIS happens to materialize on an alien spacecraft, the commander of the ship, the Reptilian Monarch, invites the Doctor and his companions to continue their journey to Earth in his company. Monarch's hospitality even extends to a generous offer to liberate the time travelers from the shortcomings of their bodies and replicate them as androids, so much more practical. Although Adric finds this proposal extremely attractive, the Doctor has good reason to be suspicious of Monarch's motives. Very few people love Florida Doomsday. Of course, I said something similar about Meglos on this program 2 weeks ago, only for a flood of pro-Meglos Twitter trolls to climb out of the woodwork. So this time I bring proof of what should be a pretty uncontroversial statement on the Doctor Who Ratings Guide review page for Florida Doomsday, the TV serial. You can find, scattered among the different reviews, the following descriptive words and phrases. Questionable, unforgivable, implausible, that's in two different reviews, by the way, stupid, boring, pointless, and then, of course, nightmare, awful, woeful, and tedious, all in the same single review. Now, of course, to any rule there are exceptions, so says your friendly retired lawyer neighborhood podcast host. There are some reviews of Florida Doomsday on the ratings guide that are positive, like Michael Hickerson's, who's now one of my listeners. Hi, Michael. As I may have mentioned earlier, I don't find any value in straight-up bashing classic Who stories. Even some of the later episodes are now over 40 years old, like this one. But Doctor Who? Still in production. Peter Davison, star of this episode, was in the most recent Who episode aired as I record this, The Power of the Doctor, not to mention his ongoing involvement with Big Finish and with the Blu-ray collections, where he comically harshes on most of his own era. With a present as strong as Doctor Who's, why bother to dole out unimaginative reviews of even lesser regarded old stories? It's not like Fort of Doomsday or Megalos killed the program, right? That was Warriors of the Deep. So, throughout this episode, I've been looking to present a more thoughtful and even-handed and less snarky review of Fort of Doomsday on TV. We have the time. It isn't like there's much new to say about Terrence's 120-page novelization. The biggest problem with Fort of Doomsday is its writer, Terrence Dudley. Dudley, bless him, was a 61-year-old man forced to write a space opera epic featuring two teenagers, Adric and Nyssa, and two characters seemingly in their 20s, Tegan and the Fifth Doctor. So Dudley makes Adric, and especially Tegan, just about the worst people ever. Tegan literally stomps on and kicks the TARDIS instruction manual in Part 4, and Adric tries to sell his soul to Monarch. Nyssa comes across well, at least, but she's only in like four scenes. This was Peter Davison's first story in production, and Dudley writes him as a generic doctor since nobody was around to tell him who this doctor was supposed to be. It wasn't until Christopher H. Binmead, who commissioned this story, our boy Chris had a fetish for colony ship stories, was brought back as a freelancer a few months later to write Castor Valva, and then he gave us a better sense of Davison's doctor as an old soul in a young man's body. But Davison does good work even on his opening night. He plays the doctor as cheerfully nervous. This worked for Patrick Troughton back in the 60s, and Davison makes it work too. And I do credit Dudley for giving the Doctor heroic things to do, especially in Part 4, staging a revolution on Monarch's ship and doing a spacewalk with the clever use of a cricket ball. That's not as bad an opening act for a Doctor as fandom would have it. And Dudley's underlying story, once you take away Adric and Tegan, is basically the plot of V, the US miniseries and follow-up TV series. Hostile reptilian alien invaders coming under the cloak of peace, but turning out to be outer space fascists. Except this airs about 15 months before V. Monarch, said it before, witty villain, lots of clever, intelligent dialogue.
With respect to your majesty, there is a sensitivity in his persona which suggests what in the flesh time was called soul.
It's the first time, Enlightenment, I've heard you blaspheme.
I beg your majesty's pardon.
I should think so. Flesh time, indeed. You approach that majesty when you put the soul into the past tense.
And, who could forget?
Our conformity. There is no other freedom.
And I refer you back to what Matt West said earlier about how Stratford Johns delivers those lines. But then, Dudley's evident misanthropy comes into play. Monarch is superficially interested in Earth's diversity, but this is one of those plot holes Barry Letts pointed out. What's the point of Monarch's collection of Earth cultures if he's just going to wipe out all of humanity? And Dudley undercuts that by having the Doctor make not one, not two, but three separate digs at Lin Futu being Chinese, and the one woman among Monarch's human captains is not permitted to utter a single word the whole story. When the right-wing fanboys whine about quote-unquote wokeness, remember, this is the version of Doctor Who that they would prefer to go back to. To quote this new Doctor,
I really don't think so. I really don't think so at all.
And that grinding noise you hear under Peter Davison's dialogue, by the way, is not Roger Limb's music, but rather the sound of the sonic screwdriver drowning out Monarch's Monopticon devices. Now, for all the reasons mentioned above, this novelization should have been dreadful. It is Terrence's first Fifth Doctor novelization, his first time writing a novelization for a non-John Pertwee or Tom Baker Doctor, for only the second time in 6 years, with Unearthly Child in the mix between mid-77 and mid-83, and he's writing for a Doctor who hasn't quite figured out who he is yet, either. A recipe for disaster? And yet, I really don't think so. I really don't think so at all. Even average Terrence is better than many other options. Terrence is not afraid to mock a script he did not understand. See Megalos, episode 75 of this podcast. See Ark of Infinity coming soon. There are moments in the Fort of Doomsday book where Terrence rolls his eyes, the recreationals are called interminable, and the Doctor notes, quote, with some relief, end quote, when one particular dance finally ends. Terrence, who used to get to script edit Robert Holmes and Robert Sloman, probably wonder just what Doctor Who needed with one dance sequence, let alone seven. He also doesn't appear to have gotten the memo that Draken was destroyed, even though he novelized that story the year before. He openly mocks Adric for his quote-unquote bossy nature, and Terrence tells us that not only that the best way to get Tegan to do something was to suggest the opposite, but further that Tegan could be exceptionally forceful, even for an Australian. Oh, snap. When Terrence describes the Urbankans as, quote, super intelligent, technologically advanced frogs, one can imagine him desperately wishing that Malcolm Hulk had been around to rewrite the script. Lastly, Terrence doesn't even try to rationalize an explanation, as he often does in other books for technobabble lines, Monarch's relieved declaration.
These will eliminate the need for telemicrographics.
And I want to point out to you that while I was watching that scene back on the video to make the edit, I remembered another great line from the novelization about Terrence putting down some of the dialogue. Page 32. Quote, "Silly, isn't it?" said the Doctor cheerfully. "Only my professor at the Academy really seemed to understand Artron energy. Just shows how academic everything is, doesn't it? Monarch treated the feeble joke with the contempt it deserved." Jason Davis also pointed out for us earlier how the sodium chloride scene is different than the book, where Adric doesn't know what sodium chloride is. That's completely inverted from the TV, where, sadly, Tegan doesn't know what sodium chloride is. As Terrence gets further along, things gather speed. Terrence also mocks the Doctor's awful joke about Lin Futu's name, well, one of the awful jokes about Lin Futu's name, helping to reestablish the character that Terrence Dudley didn't know how to write. Page 38 into 39, quote, "Either the Mandarin failed to understand the Doctor's joke, or he was polite enough to ignore it." What on TV appears to be the Doctor aimlessly wandering around the spaceship, Terrence grounds in reality, quote, "The Doctor, as usual, was poking his nose into things and hoping that some solution would present itself. It usually did, in the end." Monarch as a villain gets about a dozen or more terrific lines, which makes him one of the classic series' best humanoid enemies. Not too far behind in terms of dialogue zingers, the greats like Lynx or Scaroth. Terrence wisely gets out of the way of long passages of sparkling expository dialogue, mostly in Chapter 7. On TV, this could be a bit wearing, but Terrence sets aside his own commentary and lets the conversations between Bygone and the Doctor and between Monarch and Adric and Nyssa stand for themselves. Best of all, Terrence understands Monarch's villainy. And Terrence adds some philosophical digs, such as "a mistake that is not acknowledged cannot be corrected," or "one of the best things about flattering tyrants was that it was almost impossible to overdo it." Be warned that in some ways the book is a relic of its time. Terrence has to include Dudley's belated critique of punk culture, hence the confusion about safety pins, and writes without any apology words that we now consider offensive to refer to Lin Futu's crew. But Terrence also distances himself from the bad characterizations. There's a bizarre passage in Chapter 12 where Tegan, throwing a temper tantrum on TV over her failure to pilot the TARDIS, is elevated into, quote, "hysterical rage," and concludes with, quote, "a kind of despairing coma," thus possibly giving Tegan a gravitas in the scene which eluded Janet Fielding on TV. But even better, Tegan in the book observes shortly afterwards that when the Doctor took charge, he really took charge. Terrence Dudley may never have written for the show before, if you don't count K-9 and Company, and playing the role for the very first time, Peter Davison wasn't really fully engaged with his character, but thanks to Terrence, the resolution to Monarch's invasion scheme is unmistakably the Doctor's show. And it's a good one. Next time on Doctor Who Literature, we are scheduled to cover Book 78, the fiery conclusion to Adric's two-season-long story arc. I am chasing down a couple of things, and I may have to accommodate a guest who is temporarily unavailable. So next week we may be covering Doctor Who, Earthshock, or we may be covering something else. You will just have to tune in next time and find out. Join us, won't you? Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my two special guests, the Jason Davis and Matt West from the Cue the Winged podcast. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels. And you can find me on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages. Good night.
Direction Point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.